Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program. It's
clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, kicking off another week where we talk about the things that matter most. Today, longtime friend and really the man most responsible for the renewal of Catholic apologetics in this generation, Carl Keating, will be joining me in the second hour. He's just written a wonderful memoir about his own pilgrimage on the Camino di San Benedetto. Now, this is the Italian, this not the famous Spanish pilgrimage. This is an Italian pilgrimage. We'll tell you about it. It's fascinating. And he's written a whole book, Sun, Storm, and Solitude, about discovering hidden Italy on the Camino di San Benedetto. Now, that's coming up later today. Monica Miller will be joining us. She's going to be going to Milwaukee for the Democratic National Convention. I know it's supposed to be a virtual convention, but she's going to be there as originally planned with her own group. Also, we got news today that Hong Kong police have arrested Catholic business tycoon Jimmy Lai Chi-Ying. This is a guy who's an extraordinary entrepreneur. He started Apple Daily back in 1995. He has been an advocate for democracy. He's in the front line of those marches for democracy in Hong Kong, and Chinese government has now decided to arrest him because they claim he's colluding with foreign powers. We'll talk with Edward Penton, National Catholic Register, about that. Also, we'll be sitting down with Raymond Ibrahim about some stories out of Pakistan and the harsh blasphemy laws there. And then Saturday was the Feast of St. Dominic, one of the greats, huh? We're going to talk with Professor Thomas Madden about St. Dominic. But first, we'll get to the headlines.
Thanks, Hal. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, August 10th. It's the Feast of St. Lawrence, Deacon and Martyr. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. God is near, even when you're not searching for him. That's what Pope Francis told worshipers in St. Peter's Square yesterday. During prayer, the Pope said, having faith means keeping your heart turned to God, his love and his tenderness as a father. Pope Francis said, dark moments are the times when believers need God the most. Protests continue in Portland, Oregon, where police again declared a riot Sunday evening.
This is the Portland police. This has been declared a riot. All persons must immediately leave the area to the north or to the west.
Protesters approached a police building, threw things at officers, blocked a road, and set dumpsters on fire. Around 200 people marched to the Portland Police Association building. Police in riot gear drove the protesters back. It was the 74th night of protests in Portland since the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis' police custody. President Trump is calling the protests in Portland out of control. The executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union is calling for the Department of Homeland Security to be dismantled. Anthony Romero made his case in an op-ed to USA Today. Romero arguing that the DHS has too much power, and what has happened in Portland this summer has only proven that point. The Big Ten and Pac-12 are expected to cancel their football seasons tomorrow. According to Dan Patrick of The Dan Patrick Show, 12 of the 14 Big Ten presidents have voted against having a football season. The two universities that voted to carry on with the season were Iowa and Nebraska, according to Patrick. Multiple reports last night said the Big Ten, along with several other conferences, are planning to cancel their seasons this year. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Saturday, we celebrated the feast of St. Dominic, founder of the Dominican Order, and truly one of the most influential men in the history of the Christian faith. With me right now, Dr. Thomas Madden, professor of history and director of the Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies at St. Louis University. He's the author of many books, including Istanbul, City of Majesty at the Crossroads of the World, The Concise History of the Crusades, and a series of outstanding lecture series for the modern scholar. Well, Dr. Madden, good to have you back here. Thanks.
Hey, Al. It's always great to be on the show.
St. Dominic, clearly one of the most influential saints in the history of the Christian faith. What kind of upbringing did he have, and how was he, you might say, primed to play such an important role in the renewal and reform of the church?
Yeah, well, he was educated in Castile, where he was from, in one of the kingdoms of Spain. And he had what in the 13th century or the late 12th century would have been a very high-level education. He had spent, he got his regular degree in the arts, and then he spent 4 years in theology. This is a period in which the universities are just starting.
Right.
So he was on the cutting edge of that kind of an education.
There's a story that his mother had a dream of a dog leaping from her womb with a torch in its mouth, and the animal seemed to, quote, set the earth on fire. What's the source for that?
I think it comes from later Dominican stories about the founder. In later years, the Dominicans, or the Dominicanus, if you take that word and you slice it in half, in Latin, it's Dominicanus or canes. In other words, it would be either dog or hound of the Lord or hounds of the Lord.
Okay.
And the Dominicans, who in later centuries were very active in trying to find heretics, they saw themselves as kind of like the hunting hounds of the Lord.
Gotcha.
And so that fit well with that image.
Was he in a religious order prior to becoming the founder of one?
He was a canon's regular, which is a kind of a medieval hybrid between being in an order and being a secular clergy.
Okay.
So he was at the cathedral, it's like if we think of secular priests who live in a rectory, but then if they in that rectory they also lived a common life. So the actual rules of the order,
right,
basically is St. Augustine's rule. So they're very simple rule, but it is one in which it's much more difficult than just the regular secular life.
Do we know if he was always interested in proclaiming the gospel or winning back, you know, apostates or heretics?
No, I mean, early on, that was not. He was mostly interested in his studies.
Yeah. Okay.
But he was very taken when he traveled through, along with the Bishop of Osma, through southern France in 1203 and 1204. This was a period in which the south of France around Toulouse was really just filled with the Cathar heresy. And he was surprised at how prevalent this heresy was, and what really struck him was that there didn't seem to be any really good models for the people. That they were all being the people were being preached to by these Cathar perfecti, and these were men who seemed to the common person to be extremely holy. I mean, they lived very ascetic lives, and by comparison, the local clergy and particularly the bishops in the south of France were very, very wealthy. And they didn't seem to much care about the common people. And so for that reason, the Catholics were really scooping up a lot of converts. And that's what really worried Dominic. And that's why he really devoted the rest of his life to trying to counteract that by giving a good model for the Catholics. So he and his brothers, who he attracted, they were trained theologians who lived an ascetic life, who owned nothing, and who would preach on the streets. So it was a new kind of urban apostolate in which they would really go to where the people were. And they were willing to do open debates with the Cathar leaders, too, where they would debate with them about the merits of Catholicism versus Catharism.
How did that play with the local bishops and the local clergy?
In general, not too well. I mean, the problem was they needed the permission to preach. And generally, bishops pretty jealously guarded that.
Yeah.
But after he had obtained permission from Rome, he and his brothers, after they had shown that they were fairly successful at this, after he had received permission from Pope Innocent III, then there wasn't much they could do about it. Also, within a few years, the bishops all quickly changed their mind because not long after this, the Pope Innocent declared a crusade into southern France to get rid of all of the leaders who were refusing to assist with preaching to the Cathars.
Uh-huh.
And so that changed a lot of people's minds as soon as the crusade started bearing down on them.
Sure. So he recognized that good theology and apologetics wasn't enough. You had to have a lifestyle that was in support of, you had to have a way of life as well as a way of thinking. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. It was not only just, and of course I should say, they were highly trained and they could preach, and that was the core things that he wanted. But he also wanted them to be models of an apostolic life.
Yeah.
So they would own nothing, and they would, they're the mendicants. They were the beggars. So they would receive all of their substance from what the gifts that were given to them by the faithful.
Wow.
But they would freely give everything that they had. And that kind of model was very effective in convincing people of the sanctity, therefore, of the Catholic faith. And it put back on the heels those perfecti who were preaching Catharism.
Yeah. Yeah. What exactly was their heresy that was so dangerous?
Yeah, Catharism is a dualist heresy that essentially believes that the entire universe is divided between a good and an evil God that are evenly matched,
mm-hmm.
and that the good God is the God of the New Testament, who is pure spirit, and the evil God is the God of the Old Testament, who created the world and everything in it. And the purpose of the evil God is to enslave spirit in matter. So they saw matter as being inherently evil. And they thought the Catholic Church, therefore, was the creation of the evil God because the Catholic Church pretended that they were turning God into matter during the Mass. So you can see it was a pretty pretty strong heresy.
Yeah, yeah, serious
for the Middle
stuff.
Ages.
Yeah. Dominic gets accused of being an inquisitor. Was he an inquisitor?
No, not during his life. He was a preacher, and his order that he created was the Order of Preachers.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, there was no inquisition during his life. In later years, in the 13th century, there were already plenty of local inquisitions, mostly run by local bishops or the secular authorities. Everyone was concerned about heresy in the Middle Ages. No one thought it was a good idea, except the few heretics that there were.
Right. I mean, it was considered treasonous, right? I mean, it wasn't just in theological error, but it also was a threat to good social order.
Right, and that's why the penalty for heresy was, if you refused to repent, was usually death.
Yeah.
Not because of the Catholic Church, but because the secular lords held it to be a capital offense because
right.
you're denying the authority that they have, which mm-hmm. comes through God.
Right. Right. What's his relationship to the rosary?
There's very early sources for it. It appears that the rosary was either created within the Dominican order or it was very early on adopted. There had been other kinds of prayer beads that were used by Christians before Dominic, but it appears that the Dominicans quickly embraced it as a devotional activity, and it became very important in the Dominican order early on. And so the tradition became that St. Dominic really kind of innovated what we now see as the rosary with the five decades.
Okay.
And it was widely believed that, in fact, the Virgin Mary gave him the rosary, and then it went from there.
Did he have a reputation for apparitions or, you know, locutions or, you know, supernatural phenomena?
No, not really. He was a very quiet man, but a very determined man. He worked hard to build his order, mm-hmm. and it became focused in Rome. You know, he's the person that he would most often be compared to is Saint Francis.
I was just going to ask you about this. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. They're both contemporaries, and. St. Francis, although he also set up the other great mendicant order, the Franciscans, their approach to it was different. They were both interested in preaching, but Dominic was much more interested in theology at a high level.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Francis was very, in his life, he was very militant against owning any property or having control over any buildings whatsoever, while Dominic was not. He was willing to, if someone gave them a place, a church or a place to live, he was willing to accept that, provided that that no one held anything themselves, mm-hmm. that it was all held in common. Mm-hmm. So his was a much more pragmatic view than the kind of much more emotional view that the Franciscans had. And I think that's why the Dominicans also were the first ones into the university.
Okay.
They really pretty much took over the universities, you know, like the most famous of them,
right.
Thomas Aquinas.
Well, Zeffirelli would not have made a movie about St. Dominic like he did about St. Francis, I guess.
No, not at all.
Dr. Madden, thank you. Very helpful. We'll
thank
talk
you.
Again. Dr. Thomas Madden, Professor of History, Director of the Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies at St. Louis University.
The Call, a Call from God. Father John Trigilio shares his experience.
You know, I first felt a vocation when I was about 7 years old, made my first Holy Communion. I remember distinctly kneeling there at the communion railing, waiting for the priest to come by and bring me communion. And that's the first time I entertained the thought of, I could do this. I would like to be able to give communion to people to celebrate Mass. All through Catholic grade school, I kept thinking about it, praying about it. Finally, when I got to eighth grade, I decided I'd go to the high school seminary. I had a cousin who was a priest. He was a very holy man. He was a positive influence. My pastor was a holy man. Love the Blessed Sacrament and Our Lady, and of course, Father Levis. Those influences just kept me going through the seminary. And most of all, my mom and dad's encouragement. They never forced me to stay in. They always say, if you leave, there's no disgrace, but whatever you decide to do, we'll back you up. That helped me stay in, because where I'm at today, the people I serve in the Diocese of Harrisburg, the work I do with Father Levis on EWTN, that would never have happened. If you would have told me back in 1980 that I'd be doing Faith Matters or Web of Faith, I'd say, you know, go see a doctor because somebody hit you on the head. But the fact that I'm here is a sign that God's providence can't be conquered even by other people's influences.
For information on the priesthood or religious life, log on to www.ewtn.com/religious life.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Started drinking beer on Saturday nights, sleeping in on Sunday mornings, missing Mass, and then it just became a pattern and continued. Without God, I don't know where I'd be right now. I know the importance of the Eucharist. I know the importance of the sacraments that I didn't know at a young age. I follow God's will because my desire is to get to heaven. Our lives are rich and full by being members of the church.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-319-9999.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Well, the United States is urging Pakistan to overhaul its harsh blasphemy laws following the murder of Tahir Ahmad Nassim, an American, who was shot and killed while on trial in Pakistan. He was being tried for blasphemy. The gunman was heard to shout, "He's an enemy of Islam, he's an enemy of Pakistan." By the way, notice again the relationship between religious doctrine, religious faith, and the perceived well-being of the country. This has been a common connection throughout history, and it remains so in Muslim-majority nations. I was looking earlier today at the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom and noted that in Pakistan, they've got a myriad of reasons for charging blasphemy. If you inflict physical damage on the Quran or other Islamic religious texts, even if unintentional, that's blasphemous. If you send or receive text messages, sometimes unsolicited, which are later deemed insulting to the Prophet Muhammad or the Islamic faith, that's blasphemy. If you make comments in personal conversation that witnesses claim to be blasphemous, you can be arrested for that. I mean, it's something we don't think often enough about here, but I understand from this U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom that there's thought to be 80 people now, many of whom are what we would call on death row for blasphemy charges. We want to take a look at this newest story dealing with this fellow being shot, Tahir Ahmad Nassim, 57 years old, being shot while on profit, and to help while on trial, and to help me get a grasp of this, we've asked Raymond Ibrahim to join us again. He's a widely published author, speaker, Middle East and Islam specialist. His books include Sword and Scimitar: 14 Centuries of War Between Islam and the West. He's also edited the Al Qaeda Reader and provides expert testimony for Islam-related lawsuits, and spoken before Congress. And it's great to have you back with me, Raymond. Thanks.
Hello, Al. Very good to be with you again. Thank you.
Tell me about this particular situation with the American Tahir Ahmad Nassim, who was on trial in Peshawar.
Well, it's very much, as you were saying, basically, I know he's an American citizen of Pakistani background. I think he was an Ahmadi, which is an Islamic sect from a Western point of view. We would call it an Islamic sect, but Sunni Muslims in general, which make the majority of Pakistan would consider it a heresy not to be tolerated. But I believe he was an ex-Ahmadi. But the main point is, I believe he had a website or on social media he was presenting himself as a Messiah or maybe perhaps as a Mahdi or something of that nature, mm-hmm. which naturally angered many people. And it's believed he was lured somehow intentionally from, I think he lived in Illinois, that he was lured back to Pakistan somehow, and one thing led to another, and he was convicted of blasphemy, and then this young man sneaked in, as they say, even though he went to sneak in, he had to go through so many different barriers, and it's conceivable, if not plausible, that someone actually let him get in, someone working at the court, and he just opened fire. And I haven't seen pictures, but the descriptions are such that, you know, the people around the murdered man were just splattered with his blood. He completely unloaded on him. And the irony of all this, or probably the part that's hardest for most Americans to understand, is he's now a hero, and lawyers are apparently falling over themselves to be the ones to represent him. Because
really?
he's now being presented as a great hero, a defender of Islam in Pakistan. And whereas you would think someone here who did that, no lawyer would want to deal with
right.
him. Maybe someone would be appointed for him. They are just fighting to see who would have the honor to represent him. And in the meantime, the lawyer of the so-called blasphemer that's been murdered has gone into hiding. Because he's afraid of the situation. So that really gives you an idea of the nature of Pakistan. And really, to underscore all this, what you were saying, I'd like to actually quote the actual laws.
Yeah,
you
please.
Described them correctly. But so according to Pakistan's constitution, section 295C of its penal code specifically says, and I quote, "Whoever by words, either spoken or written, or by visible representation, or by any imputation, innuendo, or insinuation, directly or indirectly defiles the sacred name of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, shall be punished with death or imprisonment for life," excuse me, "and shall also be liable to fine." Okay, and that's just section 295C. There's many other ones. For example, section 295B of the penal code says, excuse me, and I quote, "Whoever willfully defiles, damages, or desecrates a copy of the Holy Quran or an extract therefrom, or uses it in any derogatory manner, shall be punishable with imprisonment for life." So, and the unfortunate thing is, we often hear these stories, such as this recent one, and of course, anytime one mentions blasphemy in Pakistan, the poster child of that is Asia Bibi,
right.
the woman who, of course, spent about almost 10 years on death row. And, you know, we could talk a little bit about her story, but the point is, we always get these, you know, spectacular cases that we hear about, but the reality is, this is going on, it's very endemic, and minorities in Pakistan, in this case, again, it's a minority, even though we would call him of a Muslim sect, but he's, of course, disowned by Sunni Islam in Pakistan.
Yeah, it's considered heretical, right? I mean,
right, yeah, exactly. But usually it's leveled against Christians, Hindus as well, and it's very disproportionate. So if you look at all the cases of blasphemy in Pakistan, which is about 98% Sunni Muslim, you're going to see a large percentage of Christians and Hindus, even though they only make up 1 or 2% combined. So, and it's well known that it's used, it's just used to get even. So you'll have the Asia Bibi story, of course. She was working in the farm with Muslim women, and she drank from their water, and that was it. They went off on her, they yelled at her, they cursed her, and she defended herself and said something positive about Christianity, and which they, of course, intentionally misconstrued as negative about Islam, accused her of blasphemy. She was beat. Her family was beat. She was thrown in jail, put on death row. And just to get her out was, you know, pulling teeth. And
right.
So many riots occurred in Pakistan and so forth.
Well, this is what I think people need to understand, too, in that is that, you know, even if the government in Pakistan doesn't execute anybody for blasphemy, frequently crowds will. Is that what we see happening in this case of Tahir Ahmad Nassim?
Yeah, exactly. So to date, despite as draconian as these laws are, the ones that I quoted, my understanding is no one has been formally executed. However, at least 20 people have been killed extrajudicially by mobs, by people like this, you know, this young murderer who's now a hero. So you do get killed. One of the most, you know, really tragic that I recall, I think it was in 2012 or 13, and it was a couple, a young married Christian couple. The woman was actually pregnant, and somehow they were accused of using pages from the Quran to wrap something, or they burned it. And most people in the end said it wasn't even accurate what they said. It wasn't. They didn't do what they said. But they took them and they literally burned them in an oven.
Oh.
And when they didn't burn fast enough, the mob wrapped them in flammable material and put them in an oven again to burn them alive. Oh. And, you know, they were just, people described the screaming, the smell, all because of, you know, this Quran incident. And again, you know, to really underscore this, every month I write, as I think you know, a report. I've been doing it for almost a decade, Muslim persecution of Christians, and I collate all the incidents of persecution all around the world at the hands of Muslims. And the blasphemy in Pakistan, I do not think a month ever passes, honestly, in the last 10 years, where something doesn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, it could be someone got arrested or someone was accused. They didn't get arrested, but now they were beaten and they and their family are living in the field somewhere. Or people who do get killed, again, in this manner. Many of them have died. So this issue of blasphemy is really endemic to Pakistan in particular, but it really spreads out all throughout the Islamic world, and you see the same sorts of things all throughout Muslim lands.
Let me switch gears and go to Egypt for a minute. There's a story which it just looks fascinating, but it looks just weird. A Coptic Christian wife and mother disappeared for nearly 3 months, supposedly because she had willingly converted to Islam and no longer wanted any connection to her infidel husband and three young daughters. She's been returned to her family. Now, that whole thing smells bad to me. What's the story behind that?
Well, your nose does you credit. So I actually followed this very closely, and so the woman in question, her name is Rania El-Messiah, and her last name, El-Messiah, means the Messiah, Christ. And she's a Coptic Christian woman, and 39 years old, married, three daughters, you know, the oldest is like 14, youngest maybe 9. Anyway, all of a sudden she disappears in late April, and her family goes crazy looking for her contacts, the authorities, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing happens. Then in a few days later, a cell video, just like you know, you make it with your iPhone. The video came out about a minute long, which I watched, of her. Now she's dressed in a black hijab. So before this, when you see her picture, she just looks like a regular woman. Her hair's out, you know, she dresses in dresses, you know, normal Egyptian woman, Coptic. So now she appears in a black burqa. Everything's covered except her face, so people know it's her. And she's basically saying, I've been practicing Islam for 9 years. I've finally had the courage, Allah Akbar, to convert openly. And now I don't want you people, her husband, her kids, to just bother about me, forget about me, pretend I never existed, live your life, leave me alone. And she starts crying. And then the authorities say, well, there you go. So, you know, there's nothing we can do. This is what she wants. But her family insists that, no, this is not the Rania we know. This woman actually went to church regularly every Sunday. She had just gone to a monastery to pray in the lead-up to Easter.
Wow.
She had fasted. Her social media is full of Christian images and icons and crosses and, you know, Virgin Mary and so forth. So how could this be? Okay, so long story short, it created a big uproar, and you know, and the local authorities didn't do anything. The church contacted CC, pleading for him to do anything. He didn't respond, as far as I know. But because of the stink, all of a sudden, 3 months later, just very recently, we hear that she's been returned to her family. She never converted. It's all a lie. And I see a picture of them together, and she was never a Muslim and so forth. But they won't give details because this is too scandalous.
Well, we may have more to say on this in the future if more details come out, and I'll give you a call then. Raymond, thank you so much. We'll have your site linked on ours. Thank you.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. Your search for affordable health care stops here. Since 2014, CMF Curo has provided Catholics with affordable health care sharing that goes beyond insurance. With programs that cost less than many COBRA and ACA-sponsored plans, CMF Curo is a Catholic health sharing experience that enables you to live fully alive while saving money. Call 1-833-GET-CURO to find affordable Catholic health care now. That's 1-833-GET-CURO.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The EWTN home video highlight for August is Lourdes with the Franciscan Missionaries of the Eternal Word. Go on pilgrimage with Father Joseph Mary Wolfe and Father John Paul Mary Zeller to the healing waters of Lourdes, where St. Bernadette first encountered Our Lady and where all are now called to conversion. Order your DVD set at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Hi there, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak.
Research shows that when families openly live and share their faith together, they're more able to respond positively to the challenges they face every day.
So if you're looking for help in creating that joyful place where each member of your family experiences life as a gift from God, then you will want to check out our book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide for Raising Faithful Kids.
You can find this book on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is the logic of Catholicism. Solanus Casey said, appreciation is as necessary for social order and harmony as are the laws of gravity for the physical world. Have you ever heard an atheist discredit Christianity, claiming that science disproves God? The disagreement, however, is not between science and God, but between science and theology. The discipline of science is how we imperfectly understand nature. And the discipline of theology is how we imperfectly understand the Creator. Imperfect disciplines will always disagree. But the forever harmonious agreement between nature and its Creator is a mystery to be appreciated. Today, remind your atheist friends that science and theology have a ways to go. The rest is a mystery. And that's the logic of Catholicism. Explore more at AveMariaRadio.net. Under resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
How does man fulfill his vocation? Through life in the Holy Spirit, the Catechism tells us. This life is made up of divine charity and human solidarity and is offered as salvation. Man's great dignity is rooted in his creation in the image and likeness of God. It is fulfilled in his vocation to divine beatitude. It is by our own actions, doing good and avoiding evil, freely chosen acts, that man conforms to the good promised by God. Human beings make their own contribution to their own interior growth, the Catechism tells us. With the help of grace, man can avoid sin and grow in virtue. It is Christ who reveals the mystery of the Father and his love for man, thus making man fully manifest to himself and bringing to light his exalted vocation. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Hong Kong police have arrested a Catholic business entrepreneur, Jimmy Lai Chi-ying, under the city's new national security law. Now, this is a very high-profile casualty. This is the fellow who founded Apple Daily back in 1995. He's been on the forefront of the pro-democracy movement. In fact, you see him in the front of the line frequently. He's a friend of the late Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman. And Jimmy Lai was big on the idea that open trade in China would bring about an open society. I think he's changed his mind on that since Xi Jinping became General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party. Thankfully, Edward Penton, the National Catholic Register, has been reporting on this. And Edward is the Rome correspondent for the National Catholic Register, is author most recently of The Next Pope, The Lead in Cardinal Candidates. We spoke on that just 2 weeks ago. And he reports regularly on the Holy See for a number of publications, including Newsmax, Newsweek, Zenit, the Catholic Herald, Holy Land Review. Edward, good to have you here. Thanks.
Thanks. Good to be with you again now.
This is a big deal, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's some saying it's the signals the death knell of freedom of speech in Hong Kong and the end of democracy there. It's really quite significant. And Jimmy Lai is a very well-known businessman there, entrepreneur. He's a media mogul out there, and actually came from China at the age of 13. He asked his mother if he could leave Mao's China and make a life in Hong Kong at a very young age, and did that, and set up a very successful business there, and has always fought for freedom ever since. It gave him a lot of drive to really fight for freedom and democracy and the free market too over there in Hong Kong. And so yes, this is a very big big development, and it's a signal too that this new national security law really is as serious as many critics had warned.
Right, right. I understand that he's a convert to the Catholic faith.
I believe so. Yes. I'm not quite sure when he was received, but yes, he's a convert. Yeah.
And do we know, has Pope Francis or the Holy See or anybody in the Curia, have they spoken up about this particular arrest or even about the curtailment of civil liberties in Hong Kong?
They haven't, no. Usually they won't speak up on sort of individual cases. That's quite rare. Usually they leave it to the local bishops to do that or the local church. But even so, the national security law, they haven't addressed either. And the Pope was, of course, supposed to deal with Hong Kong, at least was going to sort of draw attention to the concerns about this law last month, but he decided to omit his words from his prepared text.
That was already in a prepared text.
I mean, that's right.
That was an Angelus message or something.
We weren't allowed to report on what he was going to say, because if he doesn't say it, we're not allowed to report on it.
Right.
But he was going to actually address it, and we were actually forewarned by the press office that he was going to, and we were all ready to report on it, but then he decided to pull it at the last moment. We don't know quite why, the various theories about it, but the Pope and the Vatican have never actually addressed the problems in Hong Kong, and I don't think they even addressed this extradition law last year, which caused a lot of violent protests in Hong Kong.
I think
they remained quiet then as well, and it's all because of this provisional agreement they have with China, which comes up for renewal next month.
Yeah. Do we have any better idea this month what that treaty contains than we did last month?
Alas, no, we don't, Al, and a lot of people would love to know what's in it. There's obviously a strong suspicion that it's about the appointment of bishops, so that seems to be quite clear, but the actual detail, nobody really knows.
And that's
probably going to continue to be secret for the time being.
Do you have a sense of how big the Apple Daily is over there in terms of its media presence?
I'm not quite sure how big it is. It's certainly well known there, and it's actually been the target of the Chinese authorities for some time. They've actually been trying to steal away advertising from it and trying to bankrupt it, basically, and they've now, I think the paper has 65% of its advertising is from outside Hong Kong and China. So they've really tried to throttle it, if you like, and that's just part of the sort of persecution and intimidation that they've waged against Jimmy Lai and his companies.
Yeah. I know that you're a reporter and not a political columnist, but I'm going to ask you a question because I'd like to know what you're hearing This idea that open trade would bring about the open society, I mean, that's what back even during Nixon's days, that's what it was thought. If we can get the Chinese to trade with us, the economic freedom will eventually result in political freedom. In the circles in which you move and your colleagues, do people still believe that, or do they think that's been a mistake of American foreign policy?
I think there's certainly seems to be a consensus here that the sort of, was it the most favored nation status that was given to China, precisely because it was hoped that that would happen, was a failure. I think that's been quite clear. But I don't know whether there's a sort of sense that it hasn't worked. I think there's still hope that, with democracy and the free market, that those are means to freedom, or at least relative freedom, compared to what you get under communism.
Right.
I think that's still seen as a workable, a viable strategy. But I think the problem with China, I think, has seen that it's still still very much communist at heart. And until that goes, it will always be a veer that way and veer towards ever harder line communism, even if it tries to implement or introduce a free market, a so-called free market.
Let me switch gears here, because I understand that the hierarchy of Maronite Catholics in Lebanon have called for the resignation of the civil authorities, as a consequence of this blast that ripped apart Beirut. Is that true?
Yes, I believe Maronite Cardinal Patriarch Rai actually did call for the resignation. And I believe today the whole cabinet did resign,
okay,
if I'm not mistaken. So, it was in a homily yesterday, he called for the resignation of the entire Lebanese government as a consequence of the explosion, and because the explosion seemed to have been due to irresponsibility and negligence by the government, that he felt they should go, and they have. So yes, I believe that has happened.
Do you know if there'll be an investigation into the cause of this? I mean, have explosive agents sitting around for so long, not being, properly inventoried or something, is weird. And I'm wondering if they're going to be able to locate who's responsible for this.
I do believe that this investigation's been launched. I wrote about that last week because of the aid agencies were also calling for an investigation, and also an international one too, an international pressure put on to try and find out the cause of this, and also international help, of course, for those who are affected. I think that is going to go ahead, or at least certainly they're pushing for that to go ahead.
And what can you tell us about Pope Francis and these conjoined twins who were separated at Vatican Hospital? I understand he's baptized them.
Yes, it is quite a remarkable story. These conjoined twins from the Central African Republic, who were brought over to the Bambino Gesù, which is a Vatican-run hospital in Rome, and they were separated over, I think it was a two-year process, and really quite remarkable. They're going to live healthy lives. It's amazing surgery they've had to separate the twins. And so the mother, after the operation was successful, she asked that Pope Francis baptize them. And so they were baptized today, I think, or either certainly over the last couple of days, in the Sancta Marta residence where the Pope lives. So a very nice story, a nice uplifting story compared to what we're having mostly these days.
No, I like it. I know what you mean. I wonder, I suppose, I mean, this may sound silly, but I've never thought of it before. What about if they were not able to separate them? Would you still baptize them twice?
Good question.
I don't know. But I don't know that.
I would thought so, because they're two souls, so I expect so, but it's difficult to... I'm not quite sure. That's above my pay grade now.
What we're going into a political season here, real intense with the presidential elections coming up. What are you picking up from officials in Rome? I know there's been a lot of hostility towards President Trump. Does that mean that there is support for Joe Biden?
It's difficult to say. It's more complicated over here in Italy because, as somebody once said to me, the life issues are seen in a different way and not perhaps quite taken so seriously as they are in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that Joe Biden votes or is sort of pro-abortion politician is seen as that battle is seen to be kind of lost here. Because the legislature voted for abortion back in 1978, it's sort of seen as a done deal, and that's so it's not taken quite so seriously. Unfortunately, I think for many people, many Catholics would say, and so that's the case. So there's more sort of sympathy for someone like Joe Biden than there might be in the United States among Catholics over here in Europe. Just as there was for President Obama, a lot of people couldn't understand how, in fact, the loss of Arturo Romano was very supportive or not, was sort of sympathetic towards President Obama, despite his abortion record. But that's the way it is. So there's sort of, and there's a certain amount of, I'd say, among certainly the Italian officials, a certain suspicion, a certain perhaps dislike of President Trump among some of them. So there's that to factor in as well.
So that's still there. Yeah. In fact, I was in Rome when he was elected, as I remember it.
Right.
Yeah. There was, I know, was kind of shock. Is that because they just don't see him as a man open to, a universalist acceptance? I mean, is it the immigration thing that makes them so hostile to him?
You mean to President Trump?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's a mixture of reasons. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
But in contrast, Joe Biden is seen very much as a sort of seamless garment for a politician.
Right.
And that's certainly what they prefer, I think, a lot of them.
Okay. Yeah. Edward, thank you once again for jumping all over the place with me here. Very helpful.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thank you, Al.
Edward Penton, National Catholic Register. We'll have stories in the Crested Guest Archive if you want to follow up.
This program brought to you in part by the nonprofit Angelicum Academy.
This is Father Joseph Essio with a very important message to Catholic families. If you've been told that Catholic education is non-essential or that homeschooling is harmful, don't believe it. Catholic education is essential for forming solid citizens of both the earthly and the heavenly kingdoms, and parents are the first and primary educators given that role by God. If your schools and jobs are shut down as being allegedly non-essential, here's how to turn that to your family's advantage. Your high school students can get an outstanding Catholic education online with 75 college credits and a fully accredited associate's degree by 12th grade, saving your family over $100,000 in college costs. To learn how, go to angelicum.net. For just $3,500 a year, you can earn 75 college credits in high school, then earn their accredited BA degree just 1 year later at age 19. Check this out at angelicum.net.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
There's a simple step to raising a more grateful child. I used to say, easy, eliminate half of their material possessions. I don't say that anymore. That's ridiculous. I say 75%. They don't even miss 50. 22 stuffed animals, you go down to 11. Not exactly a hardship. Simple step to raising a more grateful child. Don't be so free with the material stuff. Research has shown more generous people, by and large, have less. You give a child less, he's more willing to share it. He also is more able to occupy himself with things like boxes and dirt balls.
and rocks. Worms. Stuff that doesn't cost a whole lot of anything.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Edward used a phrase that some may not be familiar with. It's this idea of the so-called seamless garment approach to issues, and that to be, quote, consistently pro-life, one has to have a particular stance on a variety of issues. And of course, that list grows with each succeeding few years. So you're looking at the so-called seamless garment means you have to be, if you want to claim to be authentically pro-life, then you've got to be against the death penalty. You've got to be very big for immigration. You've got to have certain attitudes towards funding for the poor. The problem is, with the whole seamless garment thing, is that it unites prudential issues with issues of which are intrinsically evil. So, obviously, a Catholic has to be for protection and empowerment of the poor. The hard thing is, what kind of legislation achieves it? And that, Christians will always be divided over.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. And good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta, and we're going to spend time this hour talking with Carl Keating, who has written a great memoir or a travelogue, I'm not sure exactly what you call it, called Sun, Storm, and Solitude, Discovering Hidden Italy on the Camino di San Benedetto. This is a different pilgrimage route than the famous Spanish pilgrimage that people take. I have to tell you, Carl's the first person I know who's gone on it. So I'm looking forward to talking to him and hearing all that he experienced. And I've actually read it through this weekend, the whole thing. And it is, I mean, the idea of the open road, right? First of all, everybody likes, I think everybody likes the idea of getting out on the open road. But you don't want to do it because you got, you know, some sort of bounty hunter after you or some posse. You want to get on the open road because it gives you a chance, what, to think. Or at least, even if you're not thinking, it gives you a chance to just kind of chill. And Carl will share with us the what he sees there in Italy. What surprised me about the book is how many of these can't even call them towns. They're hamlets. They're villages with populations like 778. You know, and that these little communities exist in throughout this route, pilgrimage route that he was on, and so he gets to interact with lots of people that you normally wouldn't be dealing with if you're working in, you know, New York City, San Francisco, Chicago. And so there's a the book has got a wonderful spirit to it. That's coming up a little bit later. We're going to spend time, though, leading off after the news with Monica Miller, who's going to be up there in Milwaukee for the Democratic National Convention. We'll tell you more about that, but first the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, August 10th. It's the Feast of St. Lawrence, Deacon, and Martyr. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. White House Press Secretary Kayla McEnany is defending President Trump's latest executive actions. Trump signing a series of orders late last week aimed at extending enhanced unemployment benefits, discouraging evictions, and deferring the payroll tax cut. McEnany said Democrats failed to deliver, so the president took action. Over the weekend, Nancy Pelosi called the actions, quote, absurdly unconstitutional. Pelosi refused to say whether she'll sue, as she said the most important priority is addressing the American people's needs. She'll also be holding out hope that coronavirus stimulus negotiations will resume. A night of looting and property damage has shaken downtown Chicago. NBC Shaquille Brewster has more on why it all started.
It comes hours after police were called about a man with a gun on Sunday afternoon. Officers located an individual in the area who they say matched the suspect's description. Police say he fired at approaching officers who then fired back, striking the shooter.
Police say large crowds could be seen breaking windows and entering stores across the Magnificent Mile in an ongoing situation. Based on a request from public safety officials, the CTA has suspended bus and train services downtown. Lebanon's government is resigning after a deadly explosion that killed more than 100 people. The country's prime minister made the announcement in an address to the nation today. The resignation comes after violent protests over the weekend. The blast happened last Tuesday and injured thousands. More than 2,000 tons of ammonium nitrate were involved. Joe Biden is expected to unveil his pick for a vice presidential running mate soon. The presumed Democratic nominee said months ago he'll choose a woman, and many people expect to pick a woman of color. California Senator Kamala Harris and former National Security Advisor Susan Rice are seen as top contenders. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. The Democrat Party has announced that they're going to hold their presidential convention virtually instead of in Milwaukee as originally planned. I'm not exactly certain how all this works out, but Dr. Monica Miller will be there. She's director of Citizens for Pro-Life Society, the author of many books, including Abandoned, The Untold Story of the Abortion Wars, and The Authority of Women in the Catholic Church. And she's going to be heading up there to conduct pro-life demonstrations during the time given to the Democratic National Convention. Monica, good to have you here. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much, Al. I really appreciate being able to talk about this.
Yeah,
now yeah, they're having a, you know, the DNC's having a quote-unquote a virtual convention, but their staging area is Milwaukee.
Right.
And we just want to have this opportunity to send the pro-life message as we are leading into this national election in November, and we want to make an issue out of abortion.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's no secret to your listeners
right.
that very sadly the Democratic Party is completely committed to legalized abortion, and the presumed candidate scandalously, you know, touting himself as a Catholic.
Yeah.
Supports abortion for the full term of pregnancy and supports Roe v. Wade that has sent over 60 million innocent human beings to their deaths.
Yeah.
And we want to make an issue out of that.
He used to oppose federal funding, I thought, but now he's even gone ahead and accepted.
He has totally sold his soul in order to get this nomination, because the Democratic Party has gone all the way over the edge. In fact, so over the edge, there was an op-ed in a recent, I think just a couple of days ago, in the Wall Street Journal that was penned by the head of Democrats for Life.
Oh, Kristen Day?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And she was right. And she was lamenting how things have even gotten worse since the Obama days.
Yeah.
Where they at least were able to, you know, make an address, or there would be some, you know, recognition that, you know, we need social programs to help women who are in crisis pregnancy. And but she says, at this point, if you're pro-life and you're a pro-life Democrat, you are completely shunned by that party at this point. And that's coming from her. She's the head of Democrat. And by the way. I'm sorry, I was going to say,
she's been on the program.
Democrats for Life are going to be at Milwaukee. They're going to be there doing their own demonstration. So,
good.
What we're going to be doing, Al, we've partnered with Created Equal. That would be Mark Harrington's pro-life group.
Sure.
We're going to be out on the streets with them Monday, August 17th, and Tuesday, August 18th. Those are the first 2 days of the convention. So here's what has to happen. If people want, who are listening to the sound of my voice right now, Al, if they want to participate with us and come out on the street with us and witness to the sanctity of life, they need to send us an email. It's very, very easy to do. You just go to our website, ProLifeSociety.com, which is all one word, ProLifeSociety.com. You click on the contact link there, or the tab, and just send us an email. Just say, I heard you on Al Cresta or whatever, and I want to be part of these demonstrations. We will send to those people who contact us where we're going to be so they can rendezvous with us.
Good.
Monday morning, Monday afternoon on the 17th, and doing it again Tuesday morning the 18th, and Tuesday afternoon on the 18th. So I really hope people will come out, especially people who live not too far away from Milwaukee or are living in Milwaukee.
Right.
They can even come from Chicago. It's only an hour, even less than 2 hour drive, you know.
Milwaukee used to have a strong pro-life movement up there, didn't it?
Oh, it's very strong, and in fact, Pro-Life Wisconsin is helping us promote the demonstration.
Good. You pointed out the problem that Democrats for Life have. I don't even know how long they can maintain an organization like that. I know that the bioethicist Charles Camasi resigned, because
he
saw it was just hopeless. And I don't know how long Kristen is going to last there. She's been on this program; it's been a few years, but early on we tried to give her as much support as we could, but it just got worse. It got stranger and stranger. She's the one who confronted Pete Buttigieg publicly about this, and
good for her.
Yeah, and it's out. There's a YouTube video of it. People can look it up and see her. She did a great job, but you know, he made it clear that she doesn't really have any place in the Democrat Party. So
no, it is and I think I've talked to you about this before. Go back to 1976.
Yeah.
When Jimmy Carter was president and was elected as president, he had the opportunity to turn that party around only 3 years post Roe v. Wade.
Yeah.
And he didn't do it.
No.
And it's been more advocacy for abortion ever since.
Yeah, well, when I interviewed him on that.
I kind of do blame him.
Yeah, well, with good reason. You can look at this two ways. You can look at the missed opportunity, because he had been a pro-life governor of Georgia.
He was the Baptist Christian, president, and very out there with his faith, and he succumbed to the growing feminist influence over that party, and he didn't do anything to steer that party in another direction.
No, I asked him about this when he was on the program here a few years ago, and he said, well, it was, he thought, this is the way he explains it publicly, well, it was a settled issue. You know, the Supreme Court had spoken, right?
Like slavery was settled, right?
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Civil rights was settled.
Right,
okay.
Right. But that's how we...
That's just a total cop-out.
I agree. It was a missed opportunity.
But here's the other thing. Before we get off on this interview, Al, I believe that the primary issue for us, especially as Catholics, is the scandal of Joe Biden professing to be Catholic yet supporting a law that sends 3,000 human beings to their deaths every day. We have to make a big deal out of that.
First of all, I know what would happen. People will say, well, what's his local bishop doing, right? Because that's the first place he should hear this is from his, well, I should hear it from his priest, and then he should hear it from his bishop. But do we have any idea that he's been confronted by his bishop?
I have no idea. I have no word of that. And it should be a public admonition.
Yeah.
We shouldn't even have to guess about it.
Right.
This is a national election we're talking
about. No,
here.
I agree.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the bishops really need to get going. They really do.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. On a few occasions, there have been strong statements made by particular bishops on this issue. But I haven't. Have you heard anybody?
Not so far, no. And
me either.
You know that we do have an open letter that's coming out.
Right.
You have agreed to sign it.
Yep.
And maybe we can talk about that a little bit more, you know, as we get closer to the election. But again, if people want to join us in Milwaukee and be a witness to life, just go to our website, prolifesociety.com. Please send us an email in the contact tab at the top of the homepage. We'll get back in touch with whoever says, I want to be with you in Milwaukee. I heard you on Al Cresta or whatever.
Yeah.
And we'll get back in touch with them.
Let's do that. And we'll have, of course, the link at our website as well. Now, so you'll be will you be able to get inside the building, do you think? Because they're going to have some place where they are.
Right, they have a convention center downtown. But we're kind of going to stay away from there.
Okay.
We're going to be doing overpasses. We might be close at one point in one of the afternoons, but we want to, you know, our message is really aimed at the general public, because it's, you know, it's Milwaukee. You guys have the convention there, or, you know, the virtual staging ground anyway. And so we want to have as broad a presence as we can within the city of Milwaukee itself.
Yeah, good. And are you getting, I know you just launched this. How's the response been so far?
Oh, I think it's been very good. And Mark Harrington has also been very vigorously promoting it, because you know that we're partnering with Created Equal,
right,
to do these demonstrations.
But Biden says he's not even going to show up there. Is that right?
That's what I've heard. So I think it's at this stage more of a I heard about that, but
yeah.
Is they actually really confirmed? I'm not sure. I think it's a maybe yes or maybe no.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think it's really set.
You could see him kind of surprising everybody by showing up.
Right, exactly.
You know, it's kind of dramatic entry. Really interesting to see what happens. Well, good. Again, how do people contact you? What's expected of them?
To hold a sign. It's just show up at our rendezvous points. We actually are having signs, professional signs made, Al, that say, Biden, you can't be Catholic and support abortion. So that'll be some of the signs that we're going to have.
Good.
But people can, again, they send us an email through the prolifesociety.com website. Tell us you want to be out with us in Milwaukee, and we will tell you where we're going to meet. And and then you'll know where to show up.
Okay, very good. Monica, thanks so much. Stay in touch.
Thank you,
and
Al.
Also, when you want to talk about the open letter, give me a call.
Oh, I absolutely
we'll do it.
I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, me too. Okay, Dr. Monica Miller, again, going to be there in Milwaukee. The Democrats have their national convention. Of course, it's a virtual convention, but there is a staging ground. There are going to be some people there, and they'll be throughout the city with their signs, trying to draw attention, again, to the contradiction in Joe Biden's claim to be Catholic And yet he's now become a champion. He doesn't just tolerate abortion. He's become a champion of abortion. I'm Al Cresta.
Father Benedict Groeschel.
I want to welcome you, if you're not familiar, with the wonderful world of the gifts of the Holy Spirit. What will America become if it makes it impossible for the Holy Spirit to work here because of untruth and self-indulgence and paganism? This is not just a nice discussion of the gifts of the Holy Spirit, because I'm going to discuss what happens when people make it impossible to be prudent, just, or honest, or brave, or courageous, or reverent. When people make that impossible, what a terrible thing they do not only to themselves, but to our society.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is Evidences for Christianity. The claim of the Christian faith is that God has revealed himself to us by appearing in the form of a man in a particular time and in a particular place. He permitted people to observe him, watch his behavior, see him under pressure, and ask him controversial questions. Seen God around lately? But there was a time when he was around. The Word became flesh, says John, and dwelt among us. This is an astounding claim that no other religion has ever made. No fuller revelation of deity seems to be possible than for God to come in person and let persons see what he is like. Surely this is better than mere writings or the testimony of a prophet, for this is the incarnation of God and the greatest evidence for Christianity. To explore more, go to AveMariaRadio.net. Under resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
I was raised a Catholic and went to church every Sunday faithfully. I met a boy and he was non-Catholic, so I left the church to be with him. When I was away from church, I yearned to be home. What brought me back was my longing for the Eucharist. The Eucharist fills me with a spirit that you can't find anywhere else. I have a peace when I walk through the doors of the Catholic Church, like that's where I belong.
We invite you to take another look at the Catholic Church. Visit CatholicsComeHome.org today.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Everyday living. Effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. I had the great pleasure over the weekend of reading a memoir of a pilgrimage by my old friend Carl Keating called Sun, Storm, and Solitude, Discovering Hidden Italy on the Camino di San Benedetto. If you asked me a few years ago what Carl would be working on as a book, this is not what I would have thought of. But this was an absolute delight to read. And as one who's in a wheelchair, reading about other people's pilgrimages over difficult terrain gives me the vicarious thrill of enjoying their trip. Carl is the founder of Catholic Answers, really, and I would argue that he's the father of the modern Catholic apologetics movement, which had fallen on hard times after the Second Vatican Council. Carl really is the one that I attribute the return of apologetics to. He's the author of at least 20 books, and as I said, most recently this one, Sun, Storm, and Solitude, Discovering Hidden Italy on the Camino di San Benedetto. Carl, great to have you back here. Thank you.
Al, it's wonderful to be with you again. Thanks for having me.
This is, it's a, like I said, a delightful book. When did you decide that you wanted to, you know, take a, this is a very different kind of book than what most people know you as producing?
Yes, it is, because it's not overtly apologetical.
Right.
And it's not intended to be. I've been interested in hiking for many years. I do a lot of that in the southwest of the U.S. And of the European countries, Italy's my favorite. So I thought, well, I'd like to take a hike slash pilgrimage in Italy. And I learned about this relatively new pilgrimage route called the Way of St. Benedict, the Camino di San Benedetto. And so I decided that was the one I would do, and I'd write up the account of the journey, which turned out to be somewhat more eventful than I expected.
I loved meeting the people that you come across throughout there, and I was shocked to realize that you really don't come across cities. You come across hamlets and villages, not even full-blown towns normally.
No, the Camino di San Benedetto is a path half on dirt trail, half on very little traveled asphalt roads that traces, in a sense, the life of St. Benedict. It starts in the town where he was born in Norcia, which is in Umbria, not all that far from Assisi. And then in the midpoint, more or less, it goes to Subiaco, where he spent his formative years and established about a dozen monasteries.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends southward at Monte Cassino, where he died. And the route is, the entire route is in the Apennine Mountains, for the northeast to the southeast of Rome.
Now, when you plan something like this, do you know, do you look at your route ahead of time, or do you rely on a guidebook, or... What kind of planning goes into this?
Yeah. Well, there's a wonderful guidebook written by a fellow named Simone Frignani. And Simone, who's become a friend of mine, laid out the route less than a decade ago and wrote the guidebook, which is wonderfully done. And it's available in English, Italian, or German. And it, the way these things work, in, since there's no true wilderness in Europe anymore.
Okay.
What you do is you don't camp out with the tent. You walk a daily stage with most of your stuff on your back, but you don't have a tent or a sleeping bag and that kind of thing. But you stay the night at some kind of lodging place. In my case, sometimes it was a hotel, a small one.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it was usually a B&B.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it was a religious establishment. But these are things that were set up by Simone, arranged for by him. When he made the route, he literally carved the route, building the trail as he went along, putting together parts of trails that existed already. So the entire trail is close to 200 miles long.
Okay. And does he maintain it himself, or does he have a group of people that are in on this with him?
He's got a group called the Amici di San Benedetto, the Friends of St. Benedict. And there are 20 people scattered along the route. And they, at their own expense, maintain the route and assist pilgrims. And they've got other local friends who assist them in doing that. So there are probably several dozen people altogether who maintain this route. It's very, very well marked. the beautiful route going through topography that I'm not too familiar with because I live in a semi-arid area here in California.
Right.
And this was lush with green, flowers, kind that I'd never seen before, some animals I'd never seen before. So it was a delightful journey, even though it had its unpleasant moments.
Hmm. Are orchids as common as yuccas?
Orchids in Italy seem to be as common as yuccas in Southern California.
Wow.
Yes. They were everywhere. And, you know, in California, the state flower is the golden poppy. Mm-hmm. But I was amazed to find that in Italy, the poppies are red and
poppies.
Large.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So you had this solid green landscape with these red poppies scattered all through it. A very interesting visual experience.
Why did Simone put this together? What was the inspiration behind it?
He had personal problems, family problems, and he was at a bit of a loss. And he was at Mass one day, and the readings were such that they really hit him.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that he was called to do something. And for the reflection, he thought this is what he was called to do.
Wow.
Set out a route that would attract today's kind of pilgrim, who is not, for the most part, a religiously oriented pilgrim. But to attract that kind of person along a historically and shall we say, liturgically Catholic route,
mm-hmm.
so that by the end of it, the pilgrim, aside from all the other benefits of hiking with learning to, you know, new friends and all this stuff, by the end of it, he would come away with a sense of the supernatural.
Yeah.
And would begin to suspect there's something more.
Yes. Yeah, this is, I was really wondering about that. If it has that kind of, it sounded like it would have that kind of impact on people. Because you point out in the book that the people who, many of the people, the large majority of people taking this way of St. Benedict, aren't there for, quote, religious reasons, but for, quote, spiritual reasons. So they're not necessarily affiliated with the Catholic faith.
Yes. Only a minority of the people identify themselves as Catholic.
Yeah.
Most would probably be nothings, shall we say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most of them are from Italy, but many are from other countries, such as Germany, because you know, that's why the German translation. And not a few Americans now. There's also a Facebook group for Americans in English about the communal.
Yeah.
So you've got people from who just want to get exercise, people just want to discover, as I wanted to, a part of Italy I hadn't seen before.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, the segment, this route only hits one real city, which is Rieti, and that's a city of 48,000. Otherwise, day by day, you're going through hamlets as small as 100 or 200 people.
Wow.
And that's because they're mainly depopulated. Over the last few decades, young people left to go to the big cities to get jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They never came back. And so you've got little towns that stretch back to the Middle Ages or earlier, which are largely empty, and yet they're so picturesque. The people in them are so kind to passersby. So, you know, it was a delight to go there. I made friends along the way that I think will be friends for a long time.
Yeah.
I look forward to going back to get to those few spots that I wish I had known about and I would have gone off to see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and there are signs of, at least all through this, there are little remnants of the religious devotion that once was so vibrant in Italy, right? I mean,
yes.
You can't escape that.
I often mention the wayside shrines I come to.
Yeah.
And some of them are rusted, closed. Obviously, whoever was last attending to them has passed away. But others are vibrantly kept up, so they're still a lively part of the local religiosity. You get a lot of that. You get a lot of course, you got a place St. Benedict was. And those, the three main spots along the way, Norcia, Subiaco, and Monte Cassino, are very moving in themselves because Benedict, of course, is the patron saint of Europe. He, more than anyone else, laid the foundation for Christian civilization that came after the fall of the Roman Empire.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so in a certain way, he is the big man of European history the last 1,500 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, without him, everything would have been different.
I'll come back to that in a minute, but I'm looking here in my notes, because we were talking about these kind of devotional sites, and I've lost it. Oh, yes, here it is. The chapter, Ghostly Houses. You write about a number of houses that you came across. I think just before you made it to Subiaco, where you found photographs taped to the doors of houses. And most of the doors had one. Now these are like black and white images. They show a man and a woman standing there, and there's a sign which says, "We used to live here."
Yeah.
And then the name, and one particular name, Familia Valentini Luigi. What is that about? I've never heard of that kind of thing.
This is in the town of Mandela, which was the stop before getting to Subiaco. And to check out Mass for the next day, I arrived on a Saturday. I walked up the hill to the Centro Storico, the old historic district, which is, as usual, at the top of the hill for fortification purposes. And I checked Mass time, and then I went beyond the church to a little piazza where a lot of doors of houses opened onto. And on each one, there was this paper, which was a photograph of people who used to live there 50 or 60 years ago. And they were all the same.
Huh.
I presume what happened is that the houses since that time have been vacant.
Wow.
And these are just memories of people who used to live there.
Wow, it's an interesting custom. I've never heard of that before. Carl, hold it there. I've got to take a break. We'll come back and continue. Carl Keating, my guest, Sun, Storm, and Solitude. It's his story of his pilgrimage, the Way of St. Benedict.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. If you're facing uncertainty with your current healthcare plan, now is the time to join CMF Curo. You can join any time during the year, and CMF Curo offers flexible Catholic healthcare solutions for individuals, families, and employers. CMF Curo is your personal healthcare advocate. Contact them today at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
This program brought to you in part by the nonprofit Angelicum Academy.
This is Father Joseph Fessio with an important message for Catholic families experiencing the effects of the shutdown of schools and employment. Catholic education is essential. You can save $100,000 as your high school students continue their Catholic education online while earning 75 college credits and an accredited associate's degree for just $3,500 per year, and an accredited bachelor's degree just 1 year later, age 19. To learn how, go to angelicum.net.
The EWTN home video highlight for August is Lourdes with the Franciscan Missionaries of the Eternal Word. Go on pilgrimage with Father Joseph Mary Wolfe and Father John Paul Mary Zeller to the healing waters of Lourdes, where St. Bernadette first encountered Our Lady, and where all are now called to conversion. Order your DVD set at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Hi there, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak.
Research shows that when families openly live and share their faith together, they're more able to respond positively to the challenges they face every day.
So if you're looking for help in creating that joyful place where each member of your family experiences life as a gift from God, then you will want to check out our book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide for Raising Faithful Kids.
You can find this book on the store page of AveMariaRadio.net.
Now, Catechism Wisdom with me, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and Father Larry Richards.
A culture that's materially comfortable gets spoiled. It says, I want my needs met. If I'm married, or even if I'm not, one of my needs, in my mind, might be, I want a child, and I want it now. For Catechism Wisdom, joining me, Father Larry Richards.
Yes.
Catechism says something here that's going to ruffle a
know.
Lot of folks.
Read me. Let me have it.
All right. Section 2378. A child is not something owed to one.
Mm.
but is a gift. Mm. The supreme gift of marriage is a human person. Wait a minute. We got the technology. Like, you know, the old bionic man. We've got the means. We can make it right.
Absolutely.
I want a kid. You know, my 10 children are all adopted.
Mm-hmm.
So the supreme gift of marriage, biologically, for me, was not a child.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Am I getting ripped off?
Mm.
And is that fair?
The reality of all things is that we're all called to be life-giving, huh? But often God does not call that, like for me, he doesn't call me to be life-giving by having my own children. You know, God's called me, but he still does it. And the same with a couple who can't have children. They can do everything that the church allows them to do, as long as they're doing it to saying, okay, I want God's will in my life. I'm not going to make God do something for me. I'm going to seek God's will. And if I work according to nature and I work according to the teaching of the church, if God decides to give me a child, absolutely, God bless. But if he doesn't, that doesn't mean I can't be fruitful. It can be like you have a go and adopt 10 children. Think about how many children in the world today have no one to care for them or love them. And so if you really, really, really want to be a mother or father, then do as you did.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Carl Keating, whose recent story of his pilgrimage on the way of St. Benedict, discovering hidden Italy on the Camino di San Benedetto. Sun, Storm, and Solitude, the name of the book. We'll have it available for you, of course. Carl, there's so many curious things here. You see early on, you go to St. Rita, to see St. Rita. She's there in Cassia, I guess is the name of it.
Right.
And you raise the question, do we see St. Rita's face, or is that a mask that covers her?
Yeah, when I went to the church at the top of the hill where the town of Cassia is, I couldn't get too close to the altar rail because of the crowd of women in front of me, all of whom wanted to implore St. Rita to assist them in some way.
Uh-huh.
So from my vantage point, looking at the glass case with the saint's body, I couldn't figure out whether I was seeing her actual face or, as in many of these cases, whether there was an artistic representation of a mask over the face.
Yeah.
So I wasn't able to figure that out.
Oh, okay. I was curious. I mean, is it a very popular site?
Very popular.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. She's one of the most popular saints in Italy.
Oh, good heavens. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, especially lost causes that of a motherly nature, you know, wayward children and that kind of thing. So commonly there'd be hundreds of pilgrims being bused in every day, you know, to visit her. Her remains there at the cathedral.
But that was unusual, right, for this Way of St. Benedict, right, to have that many people in one place.
Yes, normally, be passing through a very small town, as I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Some of them with, you know, lovely churches, lovely remains. I mean, I think came through a lovely cemetery that overlooked a very small town called Posticciola. And I found that very moving. I found a lot of things very moving on this trip.
Yeah.
I was taken by surprise many times.
Why? Why? Because you were free to you know, sit still long enough to let these things hit you?
You know, that's part of it, because the time was my own pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, I had made reservations for the next day at a B&B or what have you. So I had a certain distance I had to go. But when the skies were clear, which is about half the time, I really had the days to myself and was able to investigate and to ponder and to think about what I was seeing, and to think about the culture that I was passing through, the current culture and what had been before and the remnants of that prior culture.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you're right that the Italian countryside is filled with decaying structures, and a lot of those are devotionally related. You also said something that I was curious about. Religious sites, are they owned by the Italian government?
Yes.
And do they have the responsibility to maintain them?
Apparently not.
Yeah.
At least not very well.
Yeah.
Because now the small things like the wayside chapels and all, that's all by local people.
Okay.
The churches, as my understanding is, they're owned by the government, the national government, since 1873. And this excludes, you know, what's owned directly by the Vatican, which is, of course, a separate country.
Right.
And for legal purposes. But otherwise, throughout Italy, the physical properties of the church are owned by the government. And some of them are kept up very well. Some of them seem not to have been opened up for decades.
Hmm. Interesting. You went to a place which actually presents itself as, here we go, yeah, welcome to the medieval town of Guarcino.
Yes.
I don't know if I pronounced that right, but the streets are so narrow there that outstretched arms could have touched the neighboring walls simultaneously. That had to be, was it very much like entering what you would imagine a medieval town to be like?
You know, I don't suspect those particular streets had changed at all in 1,000 years. There certainly was no evidence of any recent construction or even reconstruction.
Yeah.
You know, you had, you know, glass and windows now that would not have been that way in the year 1200, say. But otherwise, it must have looked very close to what the kind of thing that, you know, had Dante walked through there,
yeah,
that he would have seen, you know.
Wow. Yeah, it's, that's just intriguing. There's also a spot where you come across a fresco of St. Francis.
Yeah.
And was this at Subiaco?
This is at Subiaco.
Yeah.
Subiaco is where the young Benedict left his family and for 3 years lived in a cave high on the side of a cliff. And that was his spiritually formative time. And then after that, he sort of came down from the mountain anyway and established ultimately these dozen monasteries around Subiaco.
Mm-hmm.
But now, since the Middle Ages, that whole cliffside is built out with a series of structures, including at the far end, a big monastery.
Wow.
But at the near end, two levels of churches, one above the other, and many other auxiliary rooms that are accessible to pilgrims. And in one of them, in one of the small rooms, really a chapel, you find a fresco of St. Francis of Assisi painted from life. It was painted in 1223, the year before he got the stigmata, and 3 years before his death. So you see him there, and now he's behind a sheet of plexiglass for protection. But it's almost life-size. Maybe it is life-size. And the fresco is still in pretty good condition. One of the curious things that I mentioned in the book is that I had heard that Francis was said to have one eye larger than the other.
Yeah.
And that's what's shown in the fresco.
Huh.
So I don't know if the fresco, well, I presume since it was painted from life, that it must have been either an accurate representation of him, which then gave rise to that story, or maybe an inexact painter.
Yeah.
And maybe Francis actually did have eyes of the same size. I don't know. But it's very moving to see that. And, you know, as I said, that was actually painted while he visited the complex at Subiaco.
So it was a 1223, is that right?
1223,
yeah.
Yes.
Wow. What brought Francis to Subiaco?
We don't know. Assisi would have been a few days' strong walk away back in those days. And, of course, Francis was a walker. So that would not have been a big distance for him. But the particular event, we're not sure, except we do see in that same chapel, on an opposite wall, the dedication of the chapel by a cardinal who at the time was a protector of the Franciscan order, and he later would become pope.
Huh.
And there are two figures standing behind the cardinal. They're a little hard to make out because it's faded, but one of them is reputed to be Francis. So it might have been the case that Francis accompanied the cardinal there for the dedication of this particular chapel. And even if their timing was a little bit off, the point is we do know Francis was there.
That's and to have that fresco there where it lacks the halo, so you know it's earlier.
Right.
you know.
No, no, he's still alive. Stigmata.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Elastic stigmata.
Okay? Yeah.
Which he, you know, because if it had been painted after his death, he certainly would have had a stigmata.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
No, that's exciting.
Because most images of saints or future saints from the Middle Ages are actually done after their death,
right.
Long after. But this is while he was alive. So he must have been a great fan or follower of St. Benedict.
You've got about 5 minutes left, and before I have lots of interesting questions for me, but I want to ask you, what were you most surprised by besides rain? So,
yeah, I got a lot. That's why storm in the title. From storm
right.
Yeah, I walked in May, which was supposed to have been a good month, but it turned out to be the wettest and coldest May in 20 years. aside from that, I think I was surprised by the extent of at least the cultural Catholicism that was still all around me.
Yeah.
In buildings, wayside chapels. Crucifixes everywhere. I was in one town, and right across the street from my hotel was a giant crucifix on the roadside, you know. Huh. And that was very common. There'd be many places where I would come to little chapels that would have a crucifix inside, or even an arch that you would pass under. That the arch might go back to the Middle Ages or even to Roman times, and yet there'd be, you know, Catholic symbolism there. There was a lot of that. So there, that was very encouraging to me, because there's still an undercurrent of the faith in places where I would have expected not to find much.
Yeah. Do these people generally still attend Mass in the hamlets and villages that you pass through? Do you sense that Mass is still part of their life? No.
No, because on the Masses that I went to, the attendance was very small.
Okay.
I mentioned Mandela, where I've seen the pictures on the doors of people who used to live there. When I went to church there that Sunday, there were 9 old people, I mean, older than I am,
wow,
who were there, and that was it.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the main Mass on Sunday. So, no, on the whole, I think Italians don't go to Mass. Uh-huh. But still, there's that basis there that if you can start changing their hearts and minds, they're all set up to do it.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. All the accoutrements are there.
Yeah. Yeah. If it just the spark would catch fire.
And,
yeah.
And maybe something like this, you know, a route like the Camino di San Benedetto that attracts people not just from Italy but from outside the country, that might have a way of reigniting the faith of people along the route who, you know, meet the pilgrims, even those who are not overtly religious.
Right.
But they begin to see some stirrings maybe in the pilgrims, mm-hmm. and that could cause some stirrings within themselves.
You make the point at the close of the book that you didn't, quote, go there to find yourself because you weren't aware that you had lost yourself. But what did you expect from this pilgrimage, and what did you get?
I don't know that I overtly expected anything in particular. It was a walk of discovery.
Yeah.
And I was open to whatever would come. And I think I came away, as I mentioned, I titled the last chapter Gratitude. I came away with a sense of gratitude, mostly just for having a chance to go. Gratitude for the wonderful people I met. I mean, everywhere I went. And it wasn't because I was a foreigner. I mean, many people didn't know it until, you know, I started talking.
Mm-hmm.
They just treated me so well.
Wow.
And I was able to get a sense of Italian history and culture that provided me a sense of encouragement, something I could bring home. And, you know, as I say, I have a great fondness for Italy because that's ultimately the root of the culture that I'm part of. You know, I don't have no Italian ancestry, but I mean, going back to Roman times,
of course,
that's the headquarters. And it was so calming and encouraging to find the old things that in many ways are still living in the Apennine Mountains, which is where this walk was.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, that comes through. You get that feel through the whole book. In fact, at one point you say that really the spirit of St. Benedict kind of infuses the whole area.
That's right.
Yeah. Carl, thank you very much. We'll talk again. This was wonderful. I love the read.
And, thank you, Al.
Okay. We'll talk again.
Okay.
Sun, Storm, and Solitude, Discovering Hidden Italy on the Camino di San Benedetto, Carl Keating. Delightful book. You'll wish you had taken the trip yourself.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
There is genuine consolation from the Catholic Catechism regarding the death of a loved one. The Christian who dies in Christ Jesus, we are told, is away from the body and at home with the Lord. Death marks the end of a Christian's sacramental life, but the fulfillment of his new birth, which began at baptism, now has a definitive conformity to the image of Jesus Christ. The Christian funeral does not give the deceased a sacrament or sacramentals because he or she has passed beyond the sacramental economy. The different funeral rites express the paschal character of Christian death. The greatest consolation to the Christian is the knowledge that even in death, we are separated only temporarily, that one day, if we have lived well, we will all be together again in Christ. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at solidarityhealthshare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. You know, when I picked up Carl's story of his pilgrimage to these new way of St. Benedict, I was worried that maybe I'd end up with getting a melancholy story about lost devotion. That's not what you get here. What you get is a sense of the persistence, the relentlessness of the Catholic faith. Again, Sun, Storm, and Solitude. Tonight, 8 o'clock, we're going to see on the journey home Melissa Zelnicker telling her story of coming into full communion with the Catholic faith from Judaism. And tomorrow on Crest in the Afternoon, we're going to be joined by Bill Cook. We're looking at the celebration of the feast of St. Clare of Assisi. And so Bill's going to talk about the Franciscan spirit. He's going to talk about St. Francis, and he's going to talk about St. Clare. And it's also 6 years since the death of Robin Williams. I might have some things to say about that.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.